the better you are, the worse the hand you can play. So it was kind of a long time into me playing where I all of a sudden went, hey, wait a minute, maybe those people weren't idiots. You know, maybe they were just actually playing a more nuanced version of the game than me. And I should have been paying attention to them all along, because I could have asked my brother a long time ago about, hey, you know, this person called when they were in the big blind with this hand that is really far off your list. Like, why did they do that? And then my brother could have explained, like, oh, it's different in those circumstances. And I would have actually improved at a much more rapid rate.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Future Skills, where we prepare you for a future of accelerating change. I'm Ludvig Sundström, and together with Mikael Syding, I host Future Skills. In this episode, we talk to Annie Duke. Annie is best known for her career as a professional poker player, where she's won a World Series of Poker bracelet, the World Series of Poker Tournament of Champions, and the NBC National Poker Heads Up Championship. She has more than 16 money finishes and has won more than $4 million in total. She's also the mother of four children and author of the new popular book, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. Here are some of the things that you'll learn from Annie. How she got into poker, abandoning a promising academic career in cognitive psychology. We also talk about the evolution of poker as a business and from the player's perspective, and how to spot the bluffers on the table, and how poker, finance, and other fields are all about remaining adaptive as the dynamics kind of changed up, like they did with televised poker. And this is, we talk about this in like a segment from 15 to 30 minutes, and in my opinion, this is the very best part of the episode. And even if you don't play poker, I think this episode is really about the learning process, about mastery, about becoming a better thinker and decision maker, becoming more rational. That's a really awesome ability regardless of what you do. Let's jump into the interview. So I remember, like, as a kid, maybe in my teens, and I was watching the World Poker Tour, and I'd see all these players, including you, of course, and I'd see you play. And then I never really knew anything about how to play poker. I didn't know anything about probabilistic thinking, odds, didn't know anything about cognitive biases, didn't know anything. But still, I found myself, like, in my couch, sitting there riveted to the TV screen. And I couldn't help myself from analyzing how these different players, like you, must have been perceiving the situations from their different points of view. And, like, what was their theory of mind? And I would watch poker anytime that I saw it on TV as kind of a mental practice. And I didn't think about it in that sort of sense, with that perspective, until basically when I thought about it today. But when I look back on it, that's really what it was. It was like a really good practice to see, kind of almost like practicing my empathy, looking at how these poker players were doing it, because I have nothing to practice my mind on. And then I saw these poker players playing and I was like, I wish I could be one of them and practice my mind somehow. So that's how I started playing poker. And then I started playing it online. Obviously, I was playing against amateurs and stuff like that with, you know, fake money. But I felt awesome because I went from $100 to $1 million, but I was not considering the sample size or anything. So that's kind of my start. And then here we are like 10 years later.
Yeah, that's very funny. Well, first of all, congratulations on that kind of success. I think that what's really interesting about what you said is that you said something really unusual to me about watching poker on television, which, to tell you the truth, I've never actually heard from anybody else, which is that you were watching it with empathy for what the perspective of the players must have been. I've literally never heard someone describe watching the game in that way. So what, prior to like 2002, if you tried to watch poker on TV, nobody wanted to watch it. And the reason why was that they did not show any of the whole cards. So you could think about the viewer as in an inferior position to the player. The player's position is that they know their own cards, but they don't know anybody else's cards. Prior to 2002, if you were to watch it, you didn't know anybody's cards. So you were actually in a worse position than the player. Then in 2002, these lipstick cameras came along, these little tiny cameras that they stuck in the sides of the table so that when the players saw their cards, the producers knew what the cards were, and now they would show all of the cards during the hand. And then that's when poker really exploded all over television. But notice that what that does is put the viewer in a superior position to the player, because the player doesn't know all of the cards. They only know their own cards, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, is what you're talking about in terms of having empathy for the player's position. So what ends up happening when you watch poker under those circumstances is that I think that most viewers forget that the player doesn't know what all of those cards are when they're trying to make their decisions. And so when they get bluffed, they're sort of like, oh my God, that guy made such a bad fold. Or, when they make a really bad call, they're like, how could they not have known? Except that, again, the viewer is in a much better situation than the player, and they're actually looking at the cards. So that's why I find your description of it really, really interesting, because I haven't had anybody kind of hone in necessarily when they've talked to me about that on that particular perspective. So I guess I'm not surprised that when you went and played poker, you did really well, because you seem to be watching it from a different perspective than most people that I've heard talk about it.
That's really interesting to hear. I guess if you look at the poker, I don't know really the history of professional poker as a business or an industry, but if I think about it, I could really understand that they want to expand the target group, and you can do that when you like want to dumb it down or it's not really about dumbing it down, because you are expanding it to a completely different niche that's not going to see it otherwise or care about it. But at the same time, you are dumbing it down when you're giving off the odds and everyone can feel like they're smarter, like you were saying.
Yeah. So there's two things. Well, so first of all, poker getting on TV was nothing but good for poker. I mean, let's just say that, it was a huge expansion to a much wider audience, and it did make watching it much, much more interesting. But also in the service of making it much more interesting, they did these two things. That the first was they exposed everybody's whole card. And they put the percentages up, although I don't know how much people were paying attention to that. But so they put up all the whole cards. But then the other thing that they did, which I'm sure that you'll remember from watching it, is that they only showed certain hands. So they generally only showed the hands where somebody had all of their money at stake, except for under specific circumstances. But most of the poker that you saw on TV had these very sort of big decision moments. And they didn't show, the 30 hands in between where it looked like nothing particularly interesting was happening because, somebody bet and another person folded, or there wasn't all of anybody's chips at stake, or, things just proceeded as usual.
Now they show everything, right?
It depends on the tournament that they're airing. And I don't watch a lot of poker anymore. I retired in 2012 from the game. But they do show all of the odds now, but they don't necessarily show every single hand that gets played. So what I think is really interesting about that, and some tournaments they do, you're more likely, I think, to find a poker where they do show every single hand now. But it's still not every single tournament, and they used to not show all of the hands. And what was interesting about that is that actually most of the meat of the game, most of the bulk of the decision making that you have to make during that game is those sort of 20 hands in between the big moments.
In what way do you think in terms of the odds?
What you're doing is you're trying to come up with a model of what the other person's hand is. And so you're thinking about what the range of possible hands that your opponent might have. You know what your hand is. So you know what each card in the deck is worth. So you certainly understand what the probability of your hand improving is, for sure. But then obviously you have to figure out what the probability is, first of all, that your opponent has a hand that can't possibly beat you, that your opponent has a hand that's better than yours, where you do have to improve, that your opponent has a hand that is not as good as yours, but could improve to be better than yours, and kind of what that set is. And obviously you're taking stabs at what those ranges are, about how often your opponent might have those particular holdings. And then you can just sort of look and say, same thing that you do for your hand, what are the cards in the deck that would actually improve their hand? How often does that happen? And then you come up with a kind of stab at what the probability that you think that you can win the hand.
I want to go back to the backstory of how you even got started. So you were like, as far as I can understand from your book, you were 26 years old and you were studying cognitive psychology. and you kind of you were going along this academic career path, but then something else happened and you went into poker.
Yeah, so this is where, you know, I think that I would just acknowledge here a huge influence of luck in that particular career change. During the last year that I was in graduate school, I was going to University of Pennsylvania. I was studying cognitive psychology. I had a National Science Foundation fellowship. It was my last year. And I actually had all of my job talks lined up, you know, my interviews to go become a professor, which is what my plan was. And during that year, I had been having some stomach problems. So as it was coming up to my first job interview at NYU, the stomach problems really got significantly worse. And I landed in a hospital for 2 weeks, unable to keep any food down. So I was very sick. So I had to postpone my job talks because in academics, it's seasonal. So you go out and you're interviewing to start the next September. And so if you miss those interviews, you have to wait a whole year in order to be able to finish. So I was very sick. I was very, very thin. As you can imagine, I needed to put weight back on. And I needed to take some time off in order to recuperate and get my health back. So I went to Montana with my then husband, now ex-husband. He had a house in Montana and his family lived there, and I was going to go there to recuperate. And when I got there, I needed money. I needed something to do. So that's the first luck element that intervened in that career change. And I try to say luck neutrally because at the time, of course, I thought it was quite bad luck. But I look back on it and I'm like, oh, well, that was actually kind of good luck, which just shows you that, you know, any event in your life, it's hard to put it into one category or the other. It's probably a combination of good and bad luck. So the other lucky thing that got me to change careers was that this was at a time when poker was not on television. I could not sit as a teenager, as you did, and just sort of watch poker on TV and know that this is something that people did for a living. This was in the 90s. It was not on television. There was no online poker. There would have been kind of no way for me to know, oh, you know, I need money. Let me just go play poker for a living. But my brother had moved to New York when he was 18 to go study chess. And while he was doing that, had ended up finding his way into poker in New York. And so by the time all of this happened and I got sick, he had already been playing poker for 10 years. And so he's the one who actually suggested to me. I had watched him play a little bit. And he had brought me out to Las Vegas a couple of times for vacations when I was a graduate student and, given me a little bit of money to actually go and play poker. But that was about the whole of my poker experience by that point. But he suggested to me, you know, there are legal card games in Montana. Why don't you go try doing that? If you want to try that, I'll send you some money and you can try it out. And, maybe that's something that you can do until you go back and actually finish and go into academics. So that was the only reason why I knew it existed, that was a thing that you could even do. And so there were those two things that kind of converged. And what happened was in the spring of that year, I started playing poker and, you know, I just really loved it. And this thing that I was going to do in the meantime to make money while I waited to go back to academics actually turned into almost 20 years of the meantime. So that's how I got into it.
Have you gone back to what you studied in any way?
So it's kind of interesting because I love that question because my answer to that question would be different depending on what part of my life you had asked me it. So if you asked me right as it happened, I would say, yes, I have turned my back on cognitive psychology and I've turned my back on academic. Then what happened about eight years into being a professional, so I turned professional in 94. In 2002, Eric Seidel, who is one of the best poker players of all time, very smart guy, he actually had a life as an options trader prior to becoming full-time in poker. And actually, even when he was playing poker, he did it for a little while. But he had been an options trader. And he got asked by a friend of his who had a hedge fund if he would come and speak to a retreat of the traders that traded for the fund. So Eric Seidel is many, many amazing things, but one of the things he does not enjoy and does not ever want to do is public speaking. So he had no interest whatsoever in getting in front of this audience of options traders. So he actually recommended to his friend that maybe I might like that because I used to, when I was at Penn, I actually used to teach. And so he thought this might be something that I would be good at. So just on that recommendation, I got asked if I would come and speak to this group about how poker, about how the kinds of decisions that you make in poker might inform your thinking about risk. And that was the first moment that I really sort of had to explicitly think about what the collision of what I had been doing in graduate school in cognitive psychology was with what I had been doing in poker. And I started to kind of bring those things together as I was preparing that for that first speech. And then after I did that first speech, the person who had hired me started actually recommending me out to other people. And I started building this speaking career and started thinking, more and more explicitly about this. And the conclusion that I really came to was that I hadn't left cognitive psychology at all, that I had just landed in a different laboratory, like kind of a natural laboratory for studying the exact kind of things that I had been studying when I was in graduate school. So, cognitive psychology is just studying how does your, how do you process information? You're interacting with the world. The world doesn't exist, our experience of the world is not the experience of the objective world. We have to process the world in some way. And so our experience of it is filtered through our brains. A lot of what you study when you do that is how do you learn? How does learning occur? How is the way that we process information biased? How do we deal with things like risk? And these were all questions where you can really see how people are doing this when you put them in a high pressure decision making situation, particularly one that's time compressed, particularly one where the data is incredibly noisy, like poker. And you start to see the way that people handle risk. How do people learn under those circumstances where you've got this kind of paradox of lots and lots of feedback, but also lots and lots and lots of noise in that feedback? And what dominates, the amount of feedback or the amount of noise? I mean, that's a really interesting question that you can learn by watching people play poker. So, by the time I was sort of in the 2000s and I was developing this speaking career and doing retreats and really thinking about this in a much more explicit way, it was sort of this moment of oops, I thought I had left academics, but it seems like I'm actually right back here. And I'm just studying it in a completely different way.
Would it be accurate to say that you found a superior medium for looking at what you were already really interested in?
I wouldn't say it's superior. I would say that it's very complementary. So, you do all of this work in the lab. And I think that that's a really great way in these, obviously in controlled experiments where you can control for the, you can control the variables. And actually test the null hypothesis, in order to start understanding, how do humans make decisions? Where do they go wrong? How do they learn? How do they process the world? And then you look at these kinds of natural experiments, like, the way that people behave in markets and poker is really just a market. And I think that it creates a nice complement to the work that's happening in the lab.
How is poker like the market?
Well, you're trading against other people now, aren't you? So you can think about the it's all sorts of different ways. So like the people that you're playing against will create your market conditions, right? Because you can be at a table where the people are more bearish or where they're more bullish, more aggressive or less aggressive. You have to think about what their range, like what everybody's risk tolerance is. You're always thinking about return on investment for both in a hand and in a game. The kinds of decisions that you make in a particular pot will affect the way that people perceive you and the kinds of investments you can make in the future. And you can think about it in a very specific way. You can think about, for example, the pot as what the market is offering you for your hand. And so as you're thinking about whether you want to continue with a hand or the way that you want to play a particular hand or the types of investments or how much you want to invest in the hand, you have to be thinking about what the return on investment is there. So I think there's all sorts of ways where it's very much like a market. And then there's also macro issues. So the way that the kinds of strategies that worked really well say prior to, you know, between 2002 and 2004 were really, really different than the kinds of strategies that worked after 2004. As you had all of these new players come into the game, the kinds of things that essentially the kinds of strategies that you could do, you know, at the table, really actually drastically changed. And a lot of people who had played in the 90s and were actually quite successful at it got weeded out because they didn't change their strategy as the way that everybody else was playing changed. And then there were other really big changes that occurred, actually a lot of them, you know, somewhat after I retired, which was, you know, a lot of work on game theory, optimal strategy, and a lot of analytics that people could run that just were unavailable, for example, in the 90s. And that's actually also changed the way that people play in a very drastic way. So, you know, so the conditions are kind of always changing and you need to be changing with the conditions. And so that's kind of on the a macro level. Obviously, on a micro level, you need to be sensitive to what game you're in, how are the people in the game playing. And then also even further than that, you need to think about what's happened recently in the game, because that will then change the way that a particular player might play.
All right. That's a really good in-depth explanation. And one thing that makes me think about is actually like magic, you know, magicians and things like that. So today, all the magic tricks are revealed on YouTube because like people want to seem smart. And then it becomes harder for the magicians to come up with new tricks. But if they want to be magicians, then obviously they have to come up with a new trick.
Right, exactly. So like, I mean, I can give you like a general example. In the 90s, when you were playing in a tournament, in general, people gave you a lot more credit when you were raising in particular situations. So for example, if you were to open the pot for a raise and I were to re-raise you in a tournament situation, you might actually fold a hand as a matter of course, without really thinking very much about it, that was as strong as, say, a hand like tens or jacks or queens. So that's actually quite a strong hand. But because it was such a limited group of players that were playing all the time, that the hand values, people sort of gave people credit for kind of like, well, you know that you have to have a really good hand, so you're raising in first position, and so you must have a really good hand. So if I'm willing to re-raise you, therefore I must have a really good hand. And that was a lot of sort of what the thinking was at that time. And then a couple of things happened. First of all, when poker got on television and the hole cards got revealed, people actually realized a little bit more, because that information was all of a sudden revealed to them, that actually people were re-raising with junk a lot more than you thought. And so obviously, therefore, you must be calling with junk more often in order to teach them a lesson about doing that. And then the other thing is that people just started getting much better with the analytics and really understanding what the probability of winning was in that situation, even if you did have an inferior hand, and what the range of hands that you could call or re-raise with there. And then there was just also just a lot more discussion about poker, because more and more people came into the game, more young players came into the game who were really, really, really smart and really mathematically oriented, and they weren't sort of playing like old school style. So, you know, I guess that one of the ways that I would kind of analogize it is that options trading changed drastically from, like, I mean, if you looked at what options traders were doing when they were trading on the floor in 1981, you know, without a computer screen and a lot of, you know, and those kinds of analytics that were available from that, compared to the way that they trade now. You know, obviously it's like, it's a world of difference. And in some ways, one of the things that is, I think it's similar between the two, is that a lot of the success that could come from an options trader in 1981 was kind of brute force. It's like, how aggressive were you in the crowd? Which was a very, very helpful. It was a really helpful, just sort of personality trait or style to have. You know, and now that obviously things are very, very different in the way that people trade. And I think that that's happened in poker, as more and more information has been available, more and more analytics are available. You know, the kind of computations that you can run, over a hand, obviously after the fact, when you can really look at what the mathematics of it were, it's just different.
How detailed would you say that all of these considerations were right when you were playing, like on the fly? I mean, I'm thinking of comparisons with the speed chess, where I can't see at all how they're thinking. They're just perceiving the pattern, and then they make a split second decision. And of course, you have maybe a couple of more seconds over when you play poker, but I still can't really see how you actually go through all this statistics and mathematics and thinking of relative strengths and bluffing, etc. Do you see what I mean? How much truly detailed analysis and how much is expert pattern recognition?
So it's a combination. You do have moments where you take more time. But even then, if somebody does what's called calling a clock on you, you get a minute and 10 seconds. But that's enough time to kind of, you know, do some analysis. But most of it is pattern recognition. I've been here before. I've seen this before. I've seen people behave like this before. I've seen this person behave like this before. Some of it is actually quite a bit of what you do actually is noticing when somebody isn't following a pattern, which I always used to describe as the basically noticing when the story doesn't make sense. So sometimes you're kind of running through the hand, and obviously you're doing this pretty quickly, and someone is trying to represent a particular hand, and you run through the hand and you realize that their actions up to the point where they tried to represent that hand just don't make any sense if that was the hand that they actually held. So it's a lot of pattern recognition. But what I point out to people, because I think this generalizes to life, is that intuition is, it can be very, very good. There is no doubt. And a lot of what you're doing at the poker table would go into that general category of kind of more intuitive or gut feeling or, you know, just really quick pattern recognition. I've been here before. I kind of know what to do in this situation. Where I think that that goes wrong is when you don't hold intuition accountable to a more rational process. So when you walk away from the table later, you have to be able to talk to people and really deconstruct the hands, particularly hands that you had some sort of difficulty with or hands where you have questions about it, you know, regardless of whether you won or lost the hand. Go and deconstruct those with people, and your friends should never allow you to have the answer, and you should never allow the people that you're working with to have the answer of, well, it was just my gut. My gut told me I was supposed to call. And then that's the end of the discussion. I was just going to say, like, because if that's sort of the be all and end all, like, well, my gut told me so, then that's for me a really big red flag that probably the decision wasn't optimal. Because regardless of whether you're doing it kind of by pattern recognition or gut feel or whatever in the moment, you should be able to go back and tell another human being why that was the correct decision. You should be able to explain it well enough that they can understand why you did it and also maybe repeat that decision-making and look for those kinds of situations themselves. And I know that for myself, I started actually teaching poker right around like probably 2004 or 2005, you know, as poker kind of became really big on television and really big online. There started to be a pretty wide audience, as we said, for poker. And there were people sort of hungry for seminars to be able to learn poker. And I started doing that. And during that time, actually, my game changed drastically for the better because I was having to get up in front of an audience and explain, you know, strategic choices that I was making at the table. And what happened was that because I was really forced to do that, and really communicate these concepts in a way that somebody else, another human being, could actually understand them and execute them for themselves, I discovered that a lot of the things that I was doing at the table were not optimal. And I couldn't really justify them in comparison to other choices that you might make. And I actually started to change my strategy through teaching because I was holding that my intuition accountable to a more rational process, you know, in a real way as I was trying to teach these concepts to other people.
I think that this is, at least for me, it's like this is my philosophy in every area of life, in the sense that you want to gain expert pattern recognition in some field, but most people don't. But the difficulty is to gain it. Then after you've done that, which, I mean, obviously expert knowledge, people do that, specialists in many different fields. But then the problem, kind of going back to what you're saying, is that they can't explain it to other people. They get stuck in this like curse of knowledge thing, and it becomes difficult because they weren't documenting what was going on from start to finish. So they kind of lose touch of the journey, and they think that other people will be at their level, or they get cynical about other people who are not at their level. Is that something you thought about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. And I would add to that if you're not holding yourself accountable to being able to explain it to other people, your knowledge becomes siloed. And once the knowledge is siloed, your knowledge is not you're not holding your knowledge accountable to accuracy. And I think that that's where you can really have bias start to dig in. Generally, what will happen is that because this is the way that you do things now, even if there are other people who are doing things that are different than you and having success, you're going to be more likely to start falling prey to like motivated reasoning and confirmation bias, you know, dismissing them, entrenching your own way that you do things, you know, not being open-minded to changing the way that you do things, not being open-minded to the way that other people might be operating, because you're just not being held accountable to anybody. You're not having to really kind of look at it in this unbiased way, because you're siloed. You're like your own, you become your own little echo chamber because you sort of said, well, you know, I can't really communicate it to other people. So therefore, I'm just going to keep going on doing what I'm doing. And actually, I would say that that problem that you just pointed out, I think so beautifully, is what happened. Remember, I said to you that when poker really changed, right, you know, in the mid-2000s, you know, between about early to mid-2000s, that there were a lot of players who had been very, very successful up until that point who kind of got weeded out, who sort of fell away. And I would say that those are people who siloed their knowledge, who hadn't sort of, you know, documented the journey. They weren't really trying to communicate what they knew to other people. They weren't having conversations with other people about what they knew. And what I heard from them at that time is, as things started not going so well for them, because they continued employing the exact same strategies that they had always employed, that had always worked for them, was, you know, oh, these new players, they're such idiots and I'm so unlucky. And who can play against these guys? Because they don't even know what they're doing. And, you know, I mean, it was always sort of just dismissing the other people at the table as the problem. And I think that when you say to yourself, like, look, yes, I obviously I'm successful and I kind of know what I'm doing, but I still need to hold my knowledge accountable to a rational process and being able to explain it. I think that that really helps you not fall into that problem.
All right. So it's kind of similar to the finance industry where you had these people who were just intuitive traders from years of experience on the trading floor. And then these analytical traders come in with computers and stuff. And then the old ones with experience kind of hate the new ones because they're outdoing them.
There is a different parallel as well that I'm familiar with from my career as an investment professional. And it's that they started out with grits and details and spreadsheets. And then they build up an expert recognition, and then they start relying on only that and intuition only. Whereas I myself and a few of my more successful colleagues, they use intuition as the starting point. It's a good way to filter out a handful of probably good ideas. But once you have those ideas, you have to go through them at least as carefully and thoroughly as you used to.
I cannot agree with you more. Like, I think that this is one of the biggest problems, is that we are not holding our ideas accountable. Once we feel like we have expertise, we're just done. And I think that part of the problem is that we accept that as an explanation. Like, how many times have you heard an expert trader where someone says to them, well, why did you do that? Why did you make that trade? And they were just like, you know, gut feeling. And everybody goes, okay, you know, as if that should be an acceptable explanation. And the problem is that it's fine. Like, it may be true. It may be true that your gut feeling was good enough and that's what got you there and it made you make this brilliant trade. But the problem might not be with that particular trade. It's going to come down the road as you're not holding your intuition accountable. So I think that you really need to be mindful to have this really good interaction. Well, I mean, we can think about it as, you know, the difference between, say, Kahneman, you know, Danny Kahneman and Gary Klein, or the difference between system one or system two, right? We can't do everything in system two. That would be silly. But we also shouldn't be allowing everything to happen in system one either. You need to have an interaction between the two. Let's say you need Gary Klein and Danny Kahneman to be talking to each other and saying, okay, we have this intuition, but we must be holding the intuition accountable. And I think that one of the best ways to do that is actually to teach, you know, become a mentor, teach people. You know, obviously in a firm, you would want to be teaching people within your own firm because you wouldn't necessarily want to share the IP, which I understand. You know, I mean, you could look, Feynman, Richard Feynman, his thing was, you don't really know anything until you can explain it to an 8-year-old. And what is he saying there? Well, number one, you can't get away with just jargoning your way out of it, right? Just use fancy words, and then we'll all think that you're smart.
Indubitably.
And you can't get away with just saying my intuition told me so if you have to explain it to an 8-year-old. And I think we should all follow Richard Feynman's advice. Like, you don't know anything unless you can explain it to an 8-year-old. Let's all live by that rule.
How do you actually go about teaching poker? How much is like pure theory and you telling your students, and how much is playing and getting a feeling for it, and then analyzing those feelings afterward?
Well, so obviously I don't teach poker anymore. Again, you know, I'm now retired, but when I was teaching, so first of all, I wrote a book called Decide to Play Great Poker. So that's a pretty big book on poker and would give you a good idea of how I teach, but it's actually twofold. When I teach poker, I really try hard not to tell people what to do. My approach to teaching poker was to try to help people with what they were supposed to think about in a hand. So, you know, one way that you can do it is just to say, like, if you have this hand, this is what you should do. I think that I was very sensitive, you know, possibly more than my peers, that the key was to think about what you were supposed to think about, because the kinds of things that I would read in books when I started, and there weren't a lot of books available when I started, but the kinds of advice and the kinds of strategies that they were suggesting didn't work very well for me. I think because I was an anomaly. I was a woman. And there were very few women playing. And the way that people behave at a poker table towards a woman is very, very different than the way they behave toward other people. And so I recognized that strategies that were working for the people that whose books I was reading, the kinds of things that they were recommending, just they didn't work very well for me.
So was it to your advantage or not that you were a woman?
So what I would say is that it depends on what you mean by an advantage. It was certainly
I mean in the sense that other people on the table were like underestimating you, perhaps.
Yeah. So in terms of what was actually occurring at the table, it was a very big advantage because there are biases that are, as long as you recognize them, you can really exploit strategically. So. One would be the underestimation issue. So people really underestimate your ability to bluff, for example. They think that your actions map more in a one-to-one way onto what your hand actually is. And obviously, in that case, that's pretty easily exploitable. I'll just throw out another one. There were certain people that you came across where the idea that you might be outplaying them or bluffing them would have been the horror of horrors to them. And also they sort of wanted to assert themselves over you. So they really wanted to be outplaying you and they really wanted to be bluffing you. So, you know, what you can come up with from that is that obviously their bluffing frequency against you is going to be very high. And their calling frequency against you is going to be very high. So you kind of know those two things are going to be occurring. And then obviously you can then easily exploit that. You know, that being said, when I was starting off playing in Montana, what kind of goes along with that is that there's a certain set of people that you're playing against who are calling you not very nice names, making propositions to you and kind of, you know, there's no HR department. So you can't go and say, hey, you know, this person just offered to give me my money back from the pot if I went over to the hotel with him. You know, it's just like, you just sort of, it's like, all right, well, that's an interesting way to act. There was good and bad to it, let's say, like, strategically, it was really good. And, you know, I always sort of took it in this sort of way of, you know, I'm not sitting at this table, expecting that, I'm going to be friends with this person. So I'm going to kind of ignore what they're saying to me personally and do my job. That was the way that I approached it.
I guess there must have been examples of people who, maybe you shouldn't use the word overestimate, but that were more vigilant than they would have been to another player because they know that you are very good.
So that actually happened a little bit more, after it was on television. So, once it was on television and you sort of had a name, then again, I can sort of divide people into two general groups. There were the groups who really overestimated you and were sort of afraid and much more likely to fold against you. And, once you recognize that they were just sort of scared that you were there because they recognized who you are, obviously, again, that was exploitable. And then what was really interesting, though, is that there was another group of people, and I think this was true for every pro, whether it was, Eric Seidel or Phil Hellmuth or me or whoever, where they just wanted to say, oh, I bluffed them. And for them, if they tried to bluff all their chips against you, it was sort of a win-win. They sort of felt like they were free rolling because if they won, they got to be like, oh, I bluffed Phil Hellmuth. If they lost, they got to tell a story about, I got knocked out of the tournament by Phil Hellmuth. Like, I think either way, they were kind of happy with the way that it turned out. And so you had to sort of be vigilant for that too, for the people who were trying to sort of create a story of having played with you. But as long as you know which was which, you were okay.
It sounds like you kept your ego in check most of the time, but do you have any stories where you actually let your ego get the better of you?
Yeah. So what I would say is that it was definitely a practice for me. In terms of trying to keep my ego in check. And you try. And I think that when you're thinking about it, you get better at it. But I would say every single time I played, there was some story about letting my ego get the better of me. I would say that the best example that I can give you actually was from the beginning of my career, which was, my brother had been playing for 10 years and he taught me, he really gave me a pretty strict set of hands that I should be entering the pot with under certain conditions. Particularly let's say he gave me a set of hands that I was kind of in general allowed to play. And he didn't give me a lot of nuance around that because I was new to the game. And he was just really kind of trying to get me started. But I was all like, my brother, he's already been at the final table of the World Series of Poker. And I have a list from my brother who's clearly an expert. And so now I feel like I have this expert list. And when I first started playing, I would see people who were playing hands that were off of my brother's list, that were not part of my brother's list. And I wish you could have seen the thought bubbles over my head. Like, oh, you're so bad. Look at you. Why would you be playing such a horrible hand? Man, you're terrible. And I really dismissed all of these people because they weren't playing hands that were like conforming to what my brother said that you should be playing. And then, after playing for a while and, now I'm getting into these situations where I'm starting to ask more nuanced questions of my brother and I'm starting to deconstruct hands, I start to discover that this list that he had given me was not like the be all and end all, that this was actually a pretty simplified list that was meant to get a beginner out of trouble. And that there were all sorts of circumstances where you might play hands that were off the list. I mean, for example, if you were trying to bluff somebody, that would be an example. Or if the pot was offering you the right price. Or, there's a whole set of circumstances under which you would do that. So it was kind of a long time into me playing where I all of a sudden went, hey, wait a minute, maybe those people weren't idiots. maybe they were just actually playing a more nuanced version of the game than me. And I should have been paying attention to them all along because I could have asked my brother a long time ago about, hey, this person called when they were in the big blind with this hand that is really far off your list. Like, why did they do that? And then my brother could have explained like, oh, it's different in those circumstances. And I would have actually improved at a much more rapid rate. So that's like a very obvious example of it. But I think that you fall into that trap in like a small way, every single time you play, where somebody does something that you don't understand or whatever, and your initial instinct is sort of dismiss them because you know better.
I think this is really interesting from many different angles. And I guess the first thing is that, so your brother comes there and he's like, okay, Annie, I'm going to teach you this because you're a noob. You're a beginner. So I'm going to give you this set of rules and you're just going to avoid the mistakes. And then if you avoid these mistakes, you can at least have some level of success. And then I guess over time, as you're saying, like you gain experience and you start to see the nuance. And you start going from avoiding the mistakes into like taking more risk. So it's like you could draw the analogy to this mental model, loser's game versus winner's game.
Yeah, absolutely. And how quickly I think you can shift from one to the other, and how successfully. I think ego can kind of dig in there in two ways. One is certainly in my case, it slowed me down from making that shift because I really was like, I was very rigid in believing that my brother was right and he was an expert. And so people who were doing something different than my brother had told me, I didn't even ask my brother about it because I just thought they were bad. And then the other way that I think that it can get in the way is that you actually try to make that transition too quickly. So you think that you're capable of doing things that maybe you shouldn't be. You know, you're taking on more risk than your level of skill should be allowing for yet. And, you know, as I was making the transition in poker, I would say that second problem obviously became much more, you know, much bigger for me than the first one. So, you know, one of the things in poker that's true is that and the reason why that is that a bad hand, you know, the worse the hand is, the more likely that two things are going to end up being true in the hand. The first thing, which is obvious, is that it's more likely that you're going to end up having to bluff in order to win the hand. And bluffing is hard. You need a lot of skill in order to be able to bluff successfully. And the second thing is also that you might hit the hand in a way where the hand is marginal. So there's basically there's three different kinds of hands that you can have in poker. One where you know exactly what the hand is. So that's where it's clearly in the category of I have the worst hand for sure, or I have the best hand for sure. So there's a lot of clarity around the hand. then there's a hand where it's like, my hand isn't the best hand right now, but it could improve to the best hand. So that would be a draw. So for example, if you have a flush draw, that would be in that category where you know for sure you don't have the best hand right now, but the mathematics around you know what you need to do in order to improve are quite clear. But then there's a third type of hand, which is sort of sitting in the middle zone, where so the most common version of this hand would be some sort of pair. So if you have a hand like, say, you start off with a hand like a 10 and an 8, and now, you know, the cards come down and you have a pair of 10s at the, you know, because you've matched up the 10. This is a hand where it's not a draw. You don't really kind of know what you need to do in order to improve to win the hand against another person. And it's also not very clearly the best hand because it's kind of a middle pair. And it's also not very clearly the worst hand because you have a pair. And those hands are actually the hardest hands to play because you're not quite, you know, you don't know. And the better you are at the game, the better you are at cashing in on those hands when they are good and not losing money to those hands when they aren't good. And that's actually an extremely difficult problem. So one of the things that's true in poker because of that is that when you're not so good, you want to stay with hands that are going to end up being in one of those clear places. And that's what my brother's list was doing for me. He was giving me hands where they were going to be likely to be very clearly either the best hand or the worst hand. And he was getting me to avoid hands that were likely to fall into that last category of kind of nebulous or unknown. And as you get better and better, you can add more of those hands into your game. So I would say one of the places the ego gets in the way, and you know, and this was true for me as well, is that you think that you are better than you are, and you start adding in more of those kind of in between hands at too fast a rate, and you play too many of them.
It seems like the desire to win a bluffing contest seems like a very ego kind of situation. Could you talk a bit more about bluffing in general? I mean, is it mostly local per game, or do you build a kind of knowledge base of how certain players usually bluff, how much they bluff, and in what situations they bluff?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously, when you sit down in a game, if you don't know the players, you know, you just have to take your... Essentially, everything... the way that you approach the poker is really just from a Bayesian standpoint, right? So it's, if I sit down in a game and I don't know anything about the players, I can look around the table and I can kind of understand some things about who they are likely to be. And I'm going to have, you know, I'm just going to be working off my priors in terms of, you know, what the range of hands are, how human beings generally play under certain circumstances with certain holdings, how often they're likely to play a hand and, you know, how they're likely to be reacting to the things that I'm doing. So I have all these different priors. And then as I start to collect data at the table specific to these players that I am now experiencing, I update those priors. But what you also have to do is, even if someone is a very known entity to me, so I really know who that person is, so that I've got a lot more data going into the kinds of assumptions that I'm making about the way that they play, I still must be updated, because for a variety of reasons. One is that people play differently depending on what their emotional state is, and I don't know what emotional state they're sitting down at the table with. They play differently whether they've been locally winning or losing in the game, and sometimes they've just learned something new and they're trying something new. So you're always trying to make sure that you don't kind of get stuck in your assessment of somebody, and that you are always updating about them. But there are general things that you can know. For example, if someone's a beginner, they're likely to be playing too many hands, and they're also likely to not be bluffing as much. So there are certain things that you come in and you can make assumptions about. But like I say, you always have to be updating. So actually, if we go back to the question that you had about what was one of the advantages that I had as a woman, what I found in my experience was that people had assumptions about the way that I might be playing, really just based on my gender, and that they were much less likely to update. They were much less likely to just kind of stick with their assessment of, she's a woman, this is how she plays. And even as they got new data, they wouldn't actually update what their model of me was. I think that when you're more emotionally invested in somebody, when your emotions are more involved, you're much less likely to be doing that kind of thing. So it was interesting, because when I played in Montana, I was playing against I'm not sure I ever played against a woman when I played in Montana, and most of the men were, 30 to 50 years older than me. Really old school. And so you can imagine that they had a lot of opinions about like a 25-year-old girl who was playing in the game. And what was interesting was that, I won a lot of money when I was playing in Montana. And what I kept hearing from people was, that I was the luckiest person that ever lived. She's so lucky. She's so lucky. She's so lucky. And they would tell me that to my face. I can't believe how lucky you are. And obviously that's a good sign that they're probably not updating their model of the way that I play.
I think that you were saying before how you see these players coming into the table, and then eventually their emotional state will dictate how they're playing. But how can you see, how can you kind of detect what emotional state you're in? How can you see maybe beforehand if they're going to tilt or not?
Well, so generally, well, first of all, sometimes they just wear it on their sleeve, right? So sometimes you just see that they're like, yelling at the dealer, or they're calling somebody an idiot at the table, or they're complaining. I can't believe stuff like this happens to me all the time. I'm so unlucky. That was so ridiculous. They'll say things like, how could you even play that hand? You're so bad, right? Like, so you'll, sometimes it's just very obvious because they're saying those kinds of things out loud. And that happens more often than you might imagine. But then the other thing that you're always looking for is, twofold. One is that you understand that people are more likely to tilt when they've had a recent downswing. When something has happened where they've lost with a really good hand and it was for a big amount of money, or when they've lost a lot of hands in a row. So when that happens, you're always sort of on the lookout, because you understand that it's actually likely now that they're going to be in an emotional state. And so you have that in your model. And then the other thing you're looking for is sort of drastic changes, right? Somebody who normally is only entering 20% of the pots is all of a sudden entering like, 35 or 40% of the pots. Or, they seem to be re-raising a lot more than they were before. It could be that they have a streak of really good cards, but, that's less likely than that they're actually just overplaying because they're trying to get their money back. So you're paying attention to changes in their play at the table that would signal that they've increased their frequency or increased their aggressiveness. Now, what's interesting is that is a particular way that people can tilt, but there is another way that people can tilt, which is sometimes when someone's been losing a lot, they actually become very risk averse. It's a rarer pattern, but it does happen. And so you actually need to pay attention for changes in the other direction. That all of a sudden they're not raising anymore. They're not putting pressure on their opponents, that they're more likely to be bluffed off the hand because they're just feeling sort of, woe is me, I never win. Somebody else always draws out on me. And so then you can take advantage of that if that's the type of tilter they are, because, now you're just more likely, some scary card hits the board. You're just much more likely to, bluff them there, because the frequency with which that will actually work will be higher, because they're sort of feeling like they can't win.
How has this habit of constantly observing people and judging their mental state, how has this bled into your everyday life, both in a good and a bad way?
So I just want to say, like, I personally wouldn't use the word judge, and I would use the word assess. For me, it's really important to always be trying to use language that encourages open-mindedness for myself, because I'm trying to be a good belief updater, and I'm trying to be open-minded to other people's opinions. And I feel like judge is sort of final. So I don't, you know, I mean, I guess it's definitely helpful in terms of raising my children. that, you know, I'm always trying to assess their mental state and figure out sort of where they are. It helps me know when I should de-escalate versus, you know, escalate, when it's good to take space, you know, when I'm on tilt. You know, you go on tilt a lot as a parent, and so it's good to figure that out, know to walk away. You know, I would say that where it maybe isn't helpful is that it can create a situation where when you're with other people who aren't updaters, who are thinking in a much more black and white way, that it can become frustrating. And so I think that I'm probably a little bit more likely to get frustrated in a conversation with someone, you know, where I'm having a conversation about, for example, like politics, where, you know, which is obviously a lot of the kinds of things that you discuss, you know, politics or relationships or things like that, where what I'm getting from the person that across the table is a sort of very black and white view of the world, which isn't probabilistic. They're not thinking about it probabilistically. They're not necessarily open-minded to, you know, other points of view or why other people might be right. They view the world in that very categorical way. And I think that I probably have less tolerance for that. And so maybe that kind of narrows, it might narrow my world a little bit.
I can see how you have been so used to the fact that things can surprise. And you have to be completely open-minded to the probabilities of the cards and of how people behave. And all you've done is trying to be as effective and true to reality as possible. And I can definitely see how if people around you aren't, that becomes frustrating, because you have kind of you have leveled up, and they haven't.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I would go back to that really important lesson that I learned right at the beginning of my career in poker, which we talked about, you know, which was my brother gave me this list, and then I just dismissed everybody else as wrong. And that was awful. I mean, it really delayed my improvement in the game in a way that, you know, was certainly not productive for me. And, you know, once I sort of figured out, wait a minute, like, these people who I thought were doing dumb things actually were doing something that maybe I should be incorporating into my game, I think it's such an in your face example, you know, for me it was, of, you know, when you start thinking about wrong and right, and you think about it categorically, and you don't, when someone's doing something that you don't understand, or that isn't your way of thinking or your way of doing, that you're just sort of dismissing them completely as, well, that person just doesn't know what they're doing, because clearly, like, I'm right, that you really miss out on opportunities to learn and to calibrate your own beliefs. And it's not the case that when you come across that you're going to be like, oh, that person was completely right and I was completely wrong. Of course not. It's going to be, oh, yes, indeed, some of the things that they were doing, I wouldn't want to incorporate into my game. But here's the set of things that they were doing that I do want to incorporate. And I was missing out on that set. And missing out on a more complete understanding of strategically what they were doing at the table, so that my ability to think about what my strategy should be against them was lacking, because I didn't have a complete view of what they were doing outside of my own ability to learn. And I got that lesson so early on that I think that, you know, and then it was something that I really worked on, because I had trouble with this throughout my whole career, where I would catch myself doing this and catch myself dismissing other players. I would say it was probably my biggest weakness, you know, was this tendency to just sort of dismiss what I didn't understand and then have to pull back from that precipice. But it is something that I've so been focused on trying to improve. And so I think it's hard. I think it's hard when people aren't seeing it, other people aren't seeing it in themselves.
But underlying this, underlying the whole development and also everything you're saying now, is the ability to delay doubt, to delay uncertainty. And just the other day, it was like maybe 3-4 days ago, I came across this newspaper article with a poll in it, and it had maybe a couple thousand votes in it. And the newspaper article was about Donald Trump, whether he deserved to get a Nobel Prize or not. And the poll had three options, and it was like, yes, no, maybe. I mean, it was more, it had some explanations, but that was it. Yes, no, maybe. And it was so polarized that it was 90% was either yes or no, and only 10% were in the middle, like maybe.
So it's, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I have an example from this very thing of how this is something that I am still working on and still practicing. So when I first heard the announcement that, you know, that there was going to be this meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un, and that Kim Jong-un was going to meet with Moon, and that, you know, on the table seemed to be Korea, North Korea denuclearizing, that when all of that news was coming out, my first reaction was, oh, wow, I guess that Trump's sort of like, you know, crazy man strategy, you know, of sort of, you know, very aggressive and threatening, you know, we're just going to blow you off the face of the planet and I'm going to call you Rocket Man and whatever, that, oh, I guess that worked. So I was like your pollsters, right? So it took me, I mean, in this case, it took me a couple hours where I went back and revisited that thought. And I said, oh, whoa, hold on a second. There are so many other possibilities here besides his strategy worked. So one possibility is that worked, that he scared the, you know, crap out of Kim Jong-un, and Kim Jong-un, now that sped up Kim Jong-un coming to the table. Or maybe, like, you know, there was some kind of pressure being put on China, and China was worried that Trump might blow North Korea off the planet. And so, you know, China put pressure on him or whatever. But there's this whole set where that strategy that we saw from Trump actually worked and sped up the process. And that's one possibility. But there's all sorts of other possibilities, like the economic sanctions were really, really working, that on their own, they would have gotten us to this place. And the really aggressive sort of threatening strategy of Trump actually got us closer to some sort of nuclear war than farther away. So it may be that those sanctions would have worked on their own without the threat of being blown up by an ICBM. And Trump actually got us closer to the precipice of that. So that would be like a counter way that you could think about it. You know, and then obviously, you know, and then you can go through like all those kinds of scenarios. And then you can go through all the counterfactuals. Like if Mike Pence were president, where, you know, maybe we would be in the same place. Or if Hillary Clinton were president, maybe we'd be in the same place. Or maybe America had nothing to do with it, and there was stuff happening between China and North Korea that we don't know about. But so there's all sorts of scenarios that could be going on. And one set is Trump's strategy actually really was incredibly helpful. And I had to pull back and say, well, I don't know. I mean, it has to be maybe.
So there actually is a possibility. That's what you're saying, that Trump actually deserves the Nobel Peace Prize. Obama got it. So why wouldn't Trump in this case, given all you laid out in terms of probabilities and how they actually got to this meeting?
Well, what I would say is giving somebody a Nobel Prize early does not mean that we should continue to do that, number one. What I would say is that there, among the possibilities is that this strategy worked and that we should delay because we need to see whether Kim Jong-un is actually going to follow through. So talking about it now is very early in the process. All we know is that there's a meeting that's going to occur, right? So, and that he's, you know, that he's met with Moon and that he's going to meet with Trump. And these three prisoners were released. I mean, what we really need to see is, does he actually denuclearize? Does it, you know, you need a little more time in order to see that it plays out. But if it actually plays out in a positive way, of course, this is in the set. And then it's up to the Nobel Prize Committee members to try to figure out, you know, what was the contribution of Trump and his strategy to it. But it's in the set of possibilities. The thing is that I just don't know. It was this thing of like, oh, I made this, you know, oh, wow, that worked. And then it's pulling back from that and saying, there's so much hidden information here that I can't possibly have a good opinion actually on what worked and what didn't. I'm just sitting in my house outside of Philadelphia. Like I'm not a diplomat, you know, negotiating with North Korea. What do I know? I mean, that's just sort of, you know, where I came to. What do I know?
Yeah, that doesn't stop too many people.
Well, no, it doesn't.
Coming back to what you were talking about earlier about calling people idiots or just plain wrong, in my career as an investment professional, and today as well, I typically say that you need to understand the opposite case just as well as your primary case. So if I'm going long a stock, I should be able to talk as good for shorting it as buying it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that. So one of the things that I really recommend, and then I just want to tell you guys, I have a call at 11 o'clock. So I've got 7 minutes, but, one of the things that I think is really, really important, is that we make sure that we're, you know, red team, blue teaming ourselves all the time. So you should be able to argue the other side's position. And I think that our tendency when we do that is we sort of go to through the exercise in kind of a perfunctory way, where what we actually end up arguing is a straw man version of the other side, because we're trying to argue for our position to be right. And so we go through the process. We sort of go through the motions. Okay. I need to be able to argue the short position, but you argue a weak version of the short position. What our goal should be is that I should be able to argue the short position such that somebody who was taking that position would thank me for arguing their position so well, so that they would say, wow, you argued that better than I possibly could. And when you do that, you're much more likely to come to what the truth of the matter is. You're much more likely to really understand whether your long position is something that you want to actually take, whether you actually want to put that position on. And you're much more likely just to be open-minded and change your mind and understand what the thinking of that person is. Like if I go back to that situation of having dismissed people in the beginning, one of the things that came out of being open-minded to maybe their strategy was good, what was not only did sometimes I get to incorporate their strategy, so it changed my mind and I went from long to short because I realized that actually they had a very good strategy that they were employing. But sometimes it was that I stayed long and I still thought that they shouldn't be shorting, but I understood so much better why they were doing it that it helped me play against them. It helped me, you know, take advantage of what their strategic weaknesses were better because I understood their position so much better. And so it was easier it was better for me to come up with a way to actually sort of get in and take advantage of those weaknesses that they might have. So when you argue a strong man version or a steel man version of the other side, it allows for two things. One, sometimes you change your mind. Sometimes you say, you know what, I'm not going to put this position on, or I actually want to short it. Maybe I actually am flip now. But other times you just say, I'm going to stay long, but now I understand much more what the person on the other side of this trade is thinking.
This is kind of characteristic of why we wanted to interview you, because you are like a strong truth seeker, like another one of our guests, Martin Sundquist, who is a hedge fund manager. And one of the books that he recommended that we read is from Philip Tetlock. Mm-hmm. And that book is called Super Forecasting. And it's basically about prediction and how certain you can be that, you know, before you make the prediction, then after it. So I'm wondering what kind of, when you go into a poker match, do you ever think, okay, I'll win this, 20% I'll win this game. And then afterwards, I don't know, like what's the whole process look like in the post-game analysis and everything before and after? It's kind of a vague question, but just, yeah. I just want to hear anything on your mind.
So first of all, let me say I love Phil. Phil Tetlock was nice enough to blurb my book. I really highly recommend that people read Super Forecasters. He's really amazing. And I'm actually going back to Penn to do some work with him. I'm a huge fan of him. I as a person, as a thinker. So here's the interesting thing. Like when I was playing poker again, there weren't all these analytics that you can run over the game. So it was hard to run a Monte Carlo. You couldn't sort of churn, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of hands, to really treat it like a coin flip, right? Where you can actually like run 10,000 coin flips to understand that the coin's going to land heads or tails 50% of the time. So the thing that, was probably the biggest key to my post-game analysis was when I would go and I would try to work with the people that I was seeking advice from in order to deconstruct my decision process. What I learned pretty early on is that the most important thing for me to do is only ask about the hand up to the point that I'm the decision that I'm asking about and no further. So one of the things I think it's really important to do when you're trying to get high fidelity advice from people is not tell them how it turned out. Because once somebody knows what the outcome of the hand is or the trade or whatever it is, they'll actually fit their analysis to fit the outcome. So if I were to say to somebody, oh, I had this question, you know, I did this, my opponent did this, and then I was trying to decide what to do, if I should raise or if I should fold here, you know, what do you think? I'm going to get very different advice than if I say, so I folded and then he showed me his cards and he was bluffing me. Or if I say to them, I raised and then he folded, or I raised and then he re-raised me. I mean, there's all these different ways that that hand can turn out. And if I tell them the way that it turned out, it will actually change the advice that they give me in a way that ruins the fidelity of the advice. So I figured out most of my post-game analysis involved telling people how things turned out. Not telling people rather how things turned out, and only describing hands up to the decision point that I was confused about or had a question about. And that was actually the way that I extracted the highest fidelity advice. And then the other thing, and this was something that I always demanded of my students as well, because it was demanded of me, was that the amount of detail that you have to share in order to get somebody to give you high fidelity advice is really high, that you have to be able to describe the hand down to the last detail, not just like what your position in the hand, what the betting action was, but you have to be able to say like, what was your chip stack size? What was their chip stack size? What had they been doing recently? What had you seen them do that might have informed the decision that you were, that was under consideration for you? What had they seen you do that might be informing their decision, as an example? I mean, you so much detail, and then particularly, you have to be offering up the detail, the reason why you were confused, which usually means that there's conflicting information. There's information that's kind of suggesting you should do one thing, and information that's suggesting you should do another thing. And you need to be offering up both of those. And particularly the information that disagrees with the ultimate choice that you made is very important to convey. So I would say that those are the things that really helped me the most in the post-game analysis.
All right.
Okay, we can't keep you any longer, but thank you so much for doing this.
Well, this was actually a really interesting conversation. This was completely unexpected and a completely delightful surprise in terms of what the conversation ended up being. Very different than other conversations that I've had, and really, really enjoyable. So I'm very grateful to you guys for this time. I feel like I learned a lot talking to you, and it was such a surprise what we ended up talking about. So you've made me very happy. Thank you.
Cool. Great to hear. And I think our audience will think so too.
From my perspective, I learned a lot from both hearing both of you talk, and also from, I also read your book in beforehand this, and I thought it was really good.
Oh, thank you. All right. Well, awesome. Well, hopefully we can do this sometime again in the future, because this now ranks among my favorite podcasts that I've done. So thank you so much.
Yeah, that would be great.
That's awesome.
All right. Cheers.
All right. Awesome. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed listening to this, and be sure to subscribe to our newsletter. You can either find it as a link in the description of this episode or by going to www.futureskillspodcast.com and just typing in your name in the newsletter box. And then you'll get all of our future summaries of episodes, and you'll also get access to our monthly Q&As. Okay. Thanks for listening, and have a nice day.